We are very much honored to be here to share with you our view of hearing space. This is a long project that started 40 years ago when Linda and I got married. And as you heard, she started from interdisciplinary social science and creative artistry. I started as an audio engineer, physical scientist, some cognitive science. And how do you put these two together? And I'd like to sort of initially go back to C.P. Snow, Two Cultures from the 1950s. And our version is that if you want to really understand a phenomenon, you have to see it from multiple perspectives, but not just separate multiple perspectives. You have to reconcile the perspectives. And so our goal tonight is to share with you the reconciliation of hearing space. Hearing space does not mean hearing sound. And we're going to orient this talk around a couple of questions. But the primary question is, how do you know where you are? Now, if I ask you this question, you say, this is obvious. We all do it. As human beings, we're wired to know where we are. But I will challenge you and say, how do you know, as an intellectual, as a scientist, as an artist, how do you know you're sitting here? How do you feel about where you are? Do you want to be where you are? What does it mean to be here? And we will provide the concepts, framework, and the language to deal with this question, especially from an oral perspective. How do you know where you are from the perspective of hearing? And in order to answer this question, we have to go back to the beginning. And let me take two representative examples. I have here a picture of a 19th century English urban situation. And you can clearly see the picture. But you also know that you're not in this space. You know this is a picture of some other space, that you're not there. If I wanted you to be in this space, how would you get to experience yourself in this space? Well, you might imagine yourself in this space, and you could do the entire exercise of locating yourself there by imagination. Now, this is a picture. It's a simple two-dimensional picture. If I made this a three-dimensional picture and made it all around you a 360-degree panorama and said, are you there? You'd say, well, I'm a bit more there, but I'm not really there. I can see this is a picture on the outside wall. What's missing? You can't hear, you can't smell, you can't touch. Now, in fact, if you were to close your eyes and imagine yourself in this space, you would clearly hear the carriages and the horses on the cobblestones. You would hear people shouting. You might even smell bakery going on, bread. The entire place would come alive through multiple sensory experiences of the place, and you would know where you are. Now, to really give you a feel for this, I'm going to go to the other extreme. How could you be no place? So here we have the question of how would you be in this English urban setting, and now I'm going to go to no place, what I call spaceless. On the left, we have a picture of an experiment in the 1950s in Canada where voluntary student subjects went into sensory isolation environments. And this was essentially a chamber-like bag, which you had things over your eyes, earplugs, wearing gloves, floating in a tank. You had no sensory awareness of the outside world. And if you haven't read this literature or are unfamiliar with it, you might be surprised to learn that after 15 or 20 minutes, all of these subjects began to hallucinate. And after 45 minutes, many of them began to have psychotic episodes. And after the experiment was terminated, some of these students never recovered. In other words, if I isolate you from your external world and shut down all your senses, your brain, as we say in English, flips its cookies. You can't maintain any kind of equilibrium with the sensory disconnection. Now, a non-politically incorrect version, on the right, we have a small girl wearing something over her eyes, headphones. Maybe we can imagine her wearing gloves. Maybe she has a cold and can't smell. She doesn't know where she is. She might remember having been transported to the space, but she, if she woke up in this state, would have no idea where she is. So we clearly see where you are is acquired through your senses. Yes, you can remember having gone there, but as we see from the sensory isolation, memory doesn't help you. You literally cannot maintain your sanity without a sensory connection to the external world. So we've now established that your senses determine where you are. Now, each of your senses are different in some fundamental ways, and I don't mean that your eyes are for seeing light and your ears are for sensing sound. The difference in the senses, which evolution created for very good reason, and in fact, the evolutionary psychology literature will start teaching you some of the reasons why we became what we are. Each of your senses has a different area of coverage. So I can't hear somebody drop a rock on the moon, but I can see the moon. I can hear things in this environment, but I can't hear things far away. On the other hand, each of the sensory systems, because they use a different medium of communication, have different attitudes or different properties of duration and time. So, for example, light has no sense of time. You turn the lights out, it's dark. With sound, it continues on long after the source has stopped producing sound. Sound has time in it. You have a sequence of events. You can't really get this from vision. The eye system is not designed to see high-speed sequential activities. And in fact, if you go to a typical movie, the impact of the movie comes entirely from the sound. If you listen to a movie in your home theater but turn the sound off, it disappears from your sensory experience. It becomes flat, dull, without any emotion. Every sensory system has a transport mechanism. Smell, for example, requires a static air to bring the molecules from the source to your nose. Vision has a transport mechanism, which is direct, but there's no natural illumination. Without natural illumination, you can't see anything. Whereas sound is produced by humans or natural activities. So each of these senses is fundamentally different. Now, the fourth item in there is the key. You can sense the source of the stimulation, but not the stimulation. And because of that, you get either robustness or fragileness in certain ways. So, for example, smell is very fragile. A small wind will blow the odors away. Sound is relatively fragile. Light can be fragile in the terms of it's easy to obscure. If somebody were to stand in front of me, you can't see me. But if they were to stand in front of me, you could hear me just fine because sound has other properties it flows around. Now, to answer the question, where are you? Your cognitive structure in your head, which you can't see and you can't touch, over thousands of years has been designed not just for us humans but for all mammals to take all this sensory input, integrate it, and come up with an internal representation of the external world. Now, the fact that you can't take it apart or see the process doesn't mean it isn't going on. And you have to become aware as designers of the process by which your head works, even if you don't have language to describe it. Now, let's go to the senses again. We think we understand what the senses are. And in our culture, and I presume here in the Netherlands, you think of ears are for sound, and your eyes are for light, and your nose is for smell, and your fingers are for touch. But in fact, your sensory system is not based on our nice, neat, tidy descriptions that we use in our culture. In fact, the concept of senses is culturally relative, and is even relative to different people in this audience. We don't look at our senses the same way. And there's one that I love. It's an older group that's still around, the Hausa culture in Nigeria. They have two senses, not five the way we would catalog it in Western culture. They have seeing, which is for the purpose of avoiding walking off a cliff or into a tree. And they have the other sense, which is experiencing life. And experiencing life includes memory, feelings, hearing, smell, everything but seeing. Now, that's an interesting attitude towards the senses. If you go back to the sensory anthropology literature, you will see your attitude towards the senses is much more a product of your culture than it is biology. It was not determined for you how you use your hearing. And in fact, other studies have shown that we all have sensory proclivities using the different senses in different ways. How I experience sound and how you experience it may be quite different. To really understand hearing, you've got to go to cultural relativism. Hearing is not simply your ears, which is why the scientists who measure properties about hearing get 1/10 of the story. It's a small piece of the story, and it's not the whole story. The fourth element on here is another big surprise, and that is you are how you live. And what does that mean? It means your brain is plastic. If you use a certain sense in a certain way for a certain purpose over and over again, your brain gets rewired. You can't not rewire your brain. And later on, we'll talk about people who've deliberately set out to rewire your brain. The point is, you can't avoid it. So if you live and spend most of your life listening to music, you rewire your brain. In fact, most musicians have rewired brains. I had a rewired brain in the 80s when I was the world's most whatever for reverberation systems. I had spent so much time listening to them, I could hear things in reverberation tales that nobody else in the universe could hear. And there's some funny anecdotes about that. 10 years later, I lost that ability. Had I stayed in it, I could hear things. I have colleagues who can hear which seat they are in a concert hall. They could go to the Gewandhaus as we did last night, and they could tell you all kinds of things about that. They've been in there many, many times. They've heard symphony halls around the world. They've rewired their brain to hear things. Other people could go in there, and they just hear the music. They would not hear the space. Cognitive strategies come in preferences. Okay, now I promised to talk about sound as a role in how you hear space. So let's take another look at sound. And for me, this is a very interesting view, because having spent 40 years in the audio engineering, artificial reverberation, I thought I understood sound. And in fact, I understood the physics of it, but not the experience of it. And just to challenge you, if you think you understand anything about sound, try to describe to me a sound of a breaking glass. And the answer is you can't. You can tell me, well, it dropped fast, it broke fast, it was made out of a hard material. You can tell me all the properties of the object. But if I say, no, don't tell me what made the sound, tell me what the sound is. You have no language for it. And that's an interesting and curious question about sound. Your inability to describe it, to hold on to it, doesn't mean it doesn't have very interesting properties. So let's look at some of the uniqueness about sound. It flows around obstacles. You can't stop it from flowing. It goes around that pillar over there. If I do this, you can hear properties of the wood. It reveals properties of the wood just by my banging on it. But the most important thing for this discussion is number three. You can't have natural sound other than it being created by some man-made or natural event. Whereas you can have natural illumination from the sun, you can turn on a light bulb and just leave it there, that space can be visually illuminated forever, requiring no people in it. In fact, your typical architect book can have an illuminated space with all its artistic beauty, no people. You cannot have a sound environment without something happening in it. There's nothing in nature that produces sound in the sense of, there is no equivalent of the sun for sound. You have to have events going. So sound requires energy for creation. Sound contains a time sequence. You can hear the difference between 5 millisecond events, 100 millisecond, 1,000 millisecond, 2 minutes. Sound intrinsically is a time process. Vision is not. Vision, you can take a static image, you can hold it there, you can record it. Yes, you can make a movie, but it's intrinsically not a time event. And in fact, the visual system, while it can detect some motion, is not very good at it. And in fact, if you want to portray a car in a race in a movie, you will not do it visually. You will do it through the ears, because the screeching tires tell you exactly what's going on, whereas if you would just look at it without sound, you really don't get a sense of the speed of that vehicle. Sound will radiate over large distances. Somebody could be standing behind that pillar and listening to me just fine. In fact, with the door open, they could be outside. It's a broadcast system. Sound has multiple events. I could be talking and some kid could be playing over there with his toys. You have multiple events going on in the same space. It can overlap. In the visual domain, you can't really get multiple things. If I have a visual picture, I can't see what's behind it. If I have two sound events, one in front of the other, I can hear both just fine. And in fact, if I put an obstacle between them, I can still hear both of them just fine. Sound does not respect the kind of boundaries we think of in the visual and legal sense. And the last element is the key. Sound does not respect private property. You can have all the laws you want, all the ownership, and as we'll see later, sound doesn't care. Whereas in the visual domain, you have a much better control over that. Hearing is equally different than what you might expect. It's for more than speech and music, because our whole auditory system is an evolutionary progression from the mammals, and the mammals, like the primates, didn't really have speech and music. we took speech and music and we laid it on top of an auditory system that was for other purposes. What was your auditory system for? And I'll do a digression. It turns out that your neural resources in your head are scarce materials because your head cavity could not expand from an evolutionary perspective because you couldn't have been born. So nature said, we've got this limited amount of resources in your head. What are we going to use it for to enhance survival? And as she ran these experiments, she discovered some uses for your neural resources in your head work better for survival than others, which is actually where the plasticity comes from, because if you don't use it, nature will use it for something else. So how could your auditory system be designed for survival? Well, in some species, you get what's called echolocation, the ability to visualize the external objects and geometry simply by listening with your ears. We know about dolphins and bats. It turns out when you look at the literature more carefully, there are about a dozen different species that use their ears for actually visualizing the space, and all mammals can do this to some extent. And in our culture, we have among certain blind populations what's called echolocation, and they can walk around and hear things, hear objects, hear ceilings. And earlier I was trying to explain how you can hear the ceiling. I can hear that this ceiling is way up there, even if I couldn't look at the space. And if I go onto the top floor of this building, I can hear the low ceiling, even if I was blind. And if you see the movie Ray, which is about Ray Charles, or read the book, you'll discover he taught himself to move around without a cane, without a seeing eye dog. There's a long tradition. Dan Kish teaches blind kids to walk around without their eyes. It's an ability we can develop. If you use it, it grows. If you don't, you lose it. Now, the last piece towards the bottom is much more interesting. Curiously enough, no mammals have ear lids. You can't shut off your hearing. This was not an accident. And in fact, it's wired so deep into your brain, far deeper than your visual system, that you can't turn it off. You can't influence it. It's on 24/7. You take a sleeping mother who hears her baby cry, and she's up in a moment. Her brain is processing the sound whether she wants to or not. You can't turn it off. And this is not an accident. Part of this system of not turning it off from a survival point of view is sound was events. Events have potential danger. If they've got potential danger, we're not going to give you the choice as to whether you're going to pay attention to it or not. From a social point of view, the voice is a big communicator of emotions. It's not text and language in the modern 21st century sense. It's who is that person? Now, even though you may be listening to my words and hearing what I have to say from an intellectual point of view, you're hearing far more than that. You're hearing my personality, my emotional state, my attitude. Do I care about you? Am I arrogant? Am I enjoying myself? Am I bored? All of that is coming from my voice, even if you didn't understand a word I was saying, and even if you knew no English. If you just knew Dutch, you could come away with a sense of who I was, even without the content. From an evolutionary perspective, knowing whether I was a hostile person, a friend, a supportive person, all of that was central to your survival. Without it, you were lunch. Finally, hearing is for broadcasting events over large distances. So we're beginning to get a taste of your auditory system is not for sound. Evolution didn't care about sound. She cared about all these other properties. Okay, we're starting to get a little closer to the main theme. Hearing makes you aware of dynamic events. You know what is happening. Hearing allows you to have an emotional channel for social connection. And let me illustrate that a little bit further. This is not politically correct, as we say in English. For those disability workers that work with a population that's either blind or deaf, they will tell you, if you work with the blind population, they appear completely normal in the sense they've grounded emotionally, they're easy to relate to, their psychology is intact. If you work with the deaf, they carry an extra special burden of maintaining their emotional and psychological equilibrium. They can quite nicely, but it's harder work. In other words, the two senses are not symmetric. And even though you ask the average person, which would you prefer to lose if you had to lose one? Your seeing or your hearing, they will almost tell you, I could never do without my eyes. I'll let my hearing go because I do everything with my eyes. It turns out they're wrong. if you want to maintain your equilibrium, you've got to have your hearing. There was a study in England in the 1950s where they discovered in the elderly population, 50% of the mental distress and illness could be traced to undiagnosed hearing loss. In other words, this is not a discretionary prerogative. We now see in our modern culture that there's the onset of kind of deafness as people blow their ears out. They don't understand the consequences. But rather than blowing your ears out as real deafness, there's a concept which Linda and I have been developing called functional deafness. Functional deafness doesn't mean you can't hear. Your hearing works. It means you can't hear what's important for you to hear. You are deaf to events that are important. And so let's keep in mind there's a difference between physical deafness and functional deafness. And again, if you want to really appreciate these concepts, go listen to a movie at home in a good sound system, then turn off the sound, then turn off the picture, and ask which deprives you of really appreciating the impact of the movie. And without sound, there's nothing. Now, having established this basis, let's now take away sound as the dominant piece of language. And I'm going to go back to Murray Schafer's work in the 70s. I'm sure most of you have heard of the concept of a soundscape. And in working from Murray's early work on the soundscape, I built some of this work on it until I realized it was the wrong concept. And the way to appreciate why it's not the wrong concept, it's an earlier concept than you need to really appreciate it. Now, if you'll notice, the visual architects have the concept of the landscape. They don't call it the visionscape or the lightscape. They call it the landscape. They say, this is what's out there. You may experience it through your eyes. So the soundscape really should have been the eventscape, because the fact that the event is coming to you through sound is sort of almost irrelevant. From an experiential point of view, you experience the event. And if I challenge anybody to describe what they're hearing without using a language of the event. If I pop a balloon up here and say, what did you hear? You'd say you heard a balloon pop. You can't describe it. And even in the audio engineering profession, you ask them to describe what they're hearing. And what shows up is very interesting. They'll use metaphysical borrowed words from vision. That was a muddy sound, or that was transparent or opaque. Or they'll say, that sounds just like. Now, what they're really doing is using a word not for the experience, but for a reference to the experience. So if you and I have had the same experience standing on the street corner in Amsterdam on the same street corner at the same time, I could say, it sounds just like when you stand at that street corner at 4 o'clock. I'm not describing the experience. I'm referencing it with shared experience, which means if you've had the same experience that I've had with the reverberation, tail modulation, and artificial reverberators, I could say, you remember that kind of tail we get when we... Now, I'm not describing the experience. I can't describe the experience. I have no ability to do so. So now we have the eventscape, and I'll just read this to you because it's important to keep in mind. As an architect, you are manipulating part of the eventscape. These are all oral events, meaning you can hear them. They may occur naturally, intentionally, or accidentally, and the event takes place by converting mechanical energy into sound, which is then broadcast, and this was the first broadcast system that man ever had, to the inhabitants of the space. So the eventscape is the composite of all the events that are transported to you, the listener. That's what Murray was really trying to get at, but he stopped doing work on this early, and this is the follow-on concept. So as a designer of the space, as an inhabitant of the space, you have to ask yourself the question, what is the eventscape? Because that's where you are. Do I like where I am? How do I feel about it? Can I modify it? And that's what we're talking about. Now, this eventscape is real simple. Because of the isolation in the design, there's only one event that's taking place right now, and that's me. But we could equally have the doors and windows open, and you could be subject to lots of events. Or we could have somebody in the back of the room who had too many beers and was bouncing around on the walls there. That would be events in this eventscape. So we can say the design of this space, because you thought I was interesting, was to make me the only event that you could hear. Taking this definition, we can say the soundscape is really eventscape. This is a summary of the concept, which is critically important, and we'll build on that going forward. Events are located in space. The sonic language is in terms of the events. If you want to tell me what you hear, you're going to describe all the events. You may tell me how you feel about them, what the origin of it was, but you're going to use a language of events. Even in the musical sphere, you may use a language of emotions, but you're not describing what took place, you're describing your response to it. There is no natural language of sound. And I'm going to just illustrate this. I'm going to run out of time, as I always do, but I think we got to. I'm going to play here a bunch of events, and you try to imagine where you are. Now, in each of these examples, they're very primitive, and it'll stop by itself. I now have competition for the events in this room. Now, each of these events evokes a sense of location. But these events, because of the way they were recorded and the way they're being played back in here, you have a sense of an event, but it's far away. You're not in these places. You don't have the sense there is a baby right here. You can associate with it, you can mentally imagine yourself with the baby, you can mentally imagine the driver with the horn was communicating his emotional state with the horn, but you don't feel you're out in the middle of traffic. We will come back to that distinction. But in each case, you could feel the events as events. But if I said, describe the sawing, you couldn't do that. Or tell me about the baby crying. Tell me what the sound was. You can't do it. And don't let anybody kid you. Nobody can do it. So to answer the questions I started, where are you now? You're embedded in the social and physical worlds composed of static objects, the landscape, and dynamic activities, eventscape. So your sense of place has two components. The static geometries and objects in your environment, those walls aren't moving, and the dynamic activities that produce events. That's the initial answer to the question. You don't have a complete sense of where you are dealing with just one. And if I wanted to expand this still further, I would introduce the odorscape so you could hear the smells of your environment. You might have the touchscape because you can feel yourself sitting because you feel the pressure on your rear. Without that, you wouldn't know you're sitting, even though you could look around and see the chairs. All of these senses play a role. That's how you know where you are. Now, if you're going to evaluate an eventscape, you get into a problem because as a designer, you like to think there's a good and bad, a right and wrong. And this is where it gets a little bit more subtle because like good anthropologists, you have to go talk to the natives to know what they like. Every one of you has a different set of personal preferences. Sonic events may be good or bad. You may like them, you may not. Sonic events compete, and we'll hear more about this later. This is not a free resource. So if somebody wanted to take control of this eventscape, they have to compete with me. And if I want to win the battle, I have to talk louder and louder. Events can produce what I call cognitive loading and brain arousal. It can wake you up as opposed to you falling asleep. Now, I'm talking in such a way that I'm trying to create events that are going to get your brain agitated so you don't fall asleep on me, because I get a kind of upset if people fall asleep. So I'm deliberately creating higher impact events instead of talking like this, which might in fact put you to sleep. And if I used a lot of droney sounds, you might have the sense that, all right, I'll wake up in a few minutes. It's been a long day. But I'm not doing that. I'm talking with high impact. And that's not an accident. I am deliberately creating events with impact. And this is producing brain stimulation. Now, cognitive loading, it was that if there were lots of competing events, you could still hear me and pay attention. but you'd have to work very hard at it. And after a little while, you get tired, and you say, it can't be that interesting to listen to Barry speak up there. The work I have to do to separate his message from the traffic, from all the other activities out there, just isn't worth it. And that's a typical scenario that designers often ignore. Okay, we're going to go through a little bit of, now that we've come to appreciate the eventscape, let's separate this into two pieces. There's the sounds themselves, and there's the physical environment. Now, you have never heard a pure sound. There is no such thing as a pure sound, because the sound that leaves my mouth is not the sound that enters your ears. It's being transported. In this case, it's being transported both directly and bouncing off the walls. It's being transported to the microphone, through the amplifier, through the loudspeakers, and it bounces off the walls. None of us have ever heard pure sound. You've never heard pure music. It doesn't exist. All these sound-generating events radiate different spectral patterns in different ways, and they all have to be transported to your ears. I dare say you would not enjoy this lecture putting your ear up to my mouth. Besides, it would kind of make it difficult for others. So you're actually not hearing me. You're hearing me as an event in the oral architecture of this environment. We're going to get into the oral architecture, how it modifies your experience of the events. And these are just a few introductions. For one thing, the oral architecture, in the obvious sense, just can separate the eventscapes. This is a private eventscape. If you walked outside on the street, you would not hear the events in this room. So if nothing else, you can separate your eventscape. The oral architecture changes your experience of my voice. This is not necessarily a great oral architecture for my voice. I wouldn't design this space this way. You're actually having to work harder than you should have to work because of the way in which this environment is changing it. And number three, which is my favorite, although it's not that interesting, you can hear the space because my voice illuminates it. And with a little work, you could hear, if the lights got shut off immediately and I kept talking, you could find your way out not just simply by remembering it. You could, if you paid attention and trained yourself, you could actually hear that pillar. And I used to do the experiment of having my students close their eyes, walk to a wall, and stop when their nose was 10 centimeters from the wall. And most everybody could do it on the first couple tries. Most of them actually on the first try. You can hear a wall. You can hear a ceiling. You can hear steps. You're in a hotel room and the electricity goes out. You can find your way to the doorway with your ears. You have the ability to do it. You may not be good at it until you practice a little bit. And I say sonic events illuminate the space and you can hear them. And contrary to your expectation, even if you don't think you do it, you're more comfortable doing it. If I ask you to walk down a complex flight of stairs, which you could see perfectly with your ears shut off or loud headphone music in it, you would not feel as comfortable walking down the stairs as if you can hear the sound of your footsteps. You can hear a step coming up, and if you pay attention, you're less likely to trip if you have your ears. Okay, how does the influence of oral architecture... Actually, I got to jump to a later slide. What I'm interested in introducing here is oral architecture. Many of you have heard of acoustic architecture or acoustic science, and they say, are they the same or different? And the answer is they're two completely different views of the same process. So I could come in here and measure all the acoustics of this environment. I could do simulations of it. I could predict exactly what it would sound. I could tell you the reflectivity of the walls and the cross-correlation difference. I could measure everything about the space from a physical sound wave perspective and give you numbers. That's what an acoustic architect will do, and he can predict what it would sound like based on his numbers. An oral architect takes the same space and says, what is the experience of the inhabitants in that space? So we have two different perspectives on the same space. These are not competing views. They're alternative perspectives. The paradox is the acoustic science language is clear to acoustic scientists, but there is very little for the language of oral architecture, which is how Linda and I got started on this. If we could provide a language, our hope was spaces would work better for the inhabitants. Designers could talk about it. Without some way of talking about it, there's no way to deal with it. Now, the acoustic architects have the same problem, because other than acoustic architects, nobody speaks their language. And if you ever watch a dialogue between an acoustic architect and a spatial designer for a concert hall, they're like foreign languages. They do not have a clue as to what they're talking about. And even though they might both be speaking English or both be speaking Dutch, there's no understanding that crosses that boundary. So our argument is oral architecture is the lingua franca that crosses these boundaries. Oral architecture has cultural preferences. There is no right oral architecture. Each of you may have different preferences. Linda and I designed our home, the oral architecture of our first floor, entirely to our preferences. Auditory spatial awareness is learned. You can become oblivious to it. Auditory spatial awareness, musicians have ear training, audio engineers have ear training, architects have no ear training, designers have no ear training. I put up on my web an introduction to spatial acoustics, ear training for spatial acoustics. Maybe I'll just play this one piece here. This is hand clapping in different spaces. One of the beauties of modern technology is you can actually now simulate these things, and it's much easier to do training of your ears by simulation for one simple reason. You don't have to rely on memory. So you could listen to that sequence or any other sequence and clearly hear the differences, as you could by simulating a high ceiling, low ceiling, different materials on the wall. But if I played one of those sounds for you now and then played another sound a half an hour later, even if you could hear the difference, you can't remember what you heard. Because sensory memory, like other aspects of your senses, is different than sensory sensibility and detectability. So there are many things you can really hear and appreciate, you just can't remember because you can't put a label on it. Okay, I'm going to have to rush through this, I always do it. If we want to talk about spatial experience, what language are we going to use? And I try to come up with an analogy, and I finally borrowed this picture by Escher called Relativity, and it's a visual analog to an oral experience. This is not a space. If you can't build this space, it's not buildable. But it has all the elements of spatiality. It has people walking up and down. It has windows. It has porches. It has all kinds of... So you could say this picture has high elements of spatiality, but it's not a space. Because what I'm trying to communicate to you is spatiality is the language of experience, not the language of the outside world that created it. And this is the best analogy I can come to. In the book, we developed the language of oral architecture, and it's got at least five different kinds of spatiality. Social spatiality, navigational, music, aesthetic, symbolic, and there probably are others to be discovered. Now, the same space can have one or more of these different spatiality experiences. If you're going to design a space, you've got to say, which of these spatialities is most important to me? Can I reconcile multiple spatialities? This is the language, and again, it's not what's best. We're going to do a little bit on social spatiality, because it's probably one of the most important. There's a concept called acoustic arenas and horizons. You have the horizon in the visual sense, it's how far you can see. There's an acoustic horizon in the sense that there may be events out there that I can hear. That's within my oral horizon. Things that are beyond my oral horizon, I can't hear. So the oral horizon, like the visual horizon, is the boundary between what I can hear and not hear, see and not see. There's a reciprocal version of that called the acoustic arena, and that's from the point of view of the sound source. I create an acoustic arena. Everybody within my arena can hear me. Everybody outside can't. These are measurements of distance, but they're experiential distances. They're not physical distances. In the 19th century, the concept of acoustic horizon and acoustic arena determined citizenship in the French villages. Alan Corbain did a beautiful study that showed in these 19th century French villages, the definition of citizenship was you could hear the bells. And in fact, that still survives in London. because there's one particular church. If you can hear that bells, you're a Cockney. If you can't hear those bells, you're not. Hearing the bells was so critical for your membership in the culture because the bells broadcast time, emergencies. It was the communication vehicle. It was your radio, television, and internet. If you couldn't hear this connection, you were not part of the village. And the shape of the village membership was determined by the channels which the bell sound flowed. It couldn't go over mountains, so therefore the mountains was a dividing line. If you had a sonic channel like you might a valley and the sound flowed in it, you were members of it. In a restaurant, you get these same oral horizons and arenas. You want to be sitting next to somebody and want to make them part of your acoustic horizon. Children in the backyard, in a living room, these concepts of which people can communicate and how much work it is to communicate has to do with the social spatiality. Privacy is very easy to understand from this perspective. If I have a small acoustic arena, then people outside the arena can't hear me. My activities are completely private. So privacy is the design of the arenas. And of course, I can control that to some extent. If I really want privacy, I can talk quieter. But I have to talk very quiet if the space is highly reflective and reverberant, because even talking quietly, it's going to broadcast. And there are some wonderful stories about particular resonances in certain churches. And there's one that told apocryphally about Ben Franklin on a Catholic church where the confessional was in a particular resonance in an elliptic-shaped hall, and they could talk as quiet as they want. There was a piece of space far away, which was another piece of the resonance in the elliptical foci, and you could stand there and hear completely. And there's even a funny story about positioning some visiting political dignitaries in one of these foci so he could eavesdrop far away. There was no privacy because the arenas were not shaped the way you would think they were shaped. This is from Hogarth. It's the enraged musician. He has his window open. He's complaining about the noise from the street. Now, if I were to ask you how many spaces were involved, the obvious answer would be two. And the legal confrontations in the 19th century England and later in the 20th century, first half of it, over who owned what space is depicted here. The musician is saying, it's hot, I want my window open, you're in my space. But in fact, from my perspective, there is only one space. The window's connecting them. There's not two spaces just because there's a demarcation. And he's enraged, and you now have confrontation between these two. Edwin Hall came up with the concept of social distance, which is not measured in meters. It's measured in terms of the social relationships. He had four concepts of distance: intimate, personal, conversational, and public. Each of these distances is what the social system was comfortable. If I were giving you this lecture, 10 centimeters from your nose, you'd probably be remarkably uncomfortable because that would be a distance that you might expect an intimate relationship. On the other hand, if I'm trying to do sweet talk to my mistress and she's 15 feet away, she might find that was totally inappropriate. So from an acoustic design, an oral architecture point of view, you want the acoustic horizons to match the social distances. If I have a certain kind of relationship with you, you want it to support that acoustic distance. And in your lunchroom, you have a beautiful example of that in those wooden environments for people to sit. And had you chosen to be an oral architect and designed it on purpose, you would have gotten the gold star from me as really understanding oral architecture because it serves a purpose. And you can take credit for having designed it on purpose. Okay, so this is an example of how you would merge oral architecture with the physical design process with the science. I'm going to quickly jump through these because I'm going to... Linda and I could do about an 8-hour lecture if you ever have enough time, but we're trying to compress it. I'm just going to go to the picture. You can hear space I've mentioned. This is a group of blind teenagers riding their bicycle in the mountains of California. These three teenagers are blind, and they are perfectly comfortable riding their bike. They can hear the environment. That doesn't mean they can hear sounds. They can hear what the environment does to the sounds, and they can hear the bushes, they can hear the potholes coming up, and as they get more and more training, they can hear more and more. They are rewiring their brains. Musical spatiality. I know there are people that are particularly interested in music. It's not what it seems. The history of music, which Linda will get into, ended up that musical spatiality has only two experiential dimensions. Everything else is in the details. And that is, the enclosed spaces have come in our culture to provide two functions. They produce temporal spreading. Temporal spreading means you take a single event like a flute note, and reverberation will spread it in time and give it a reverberation tail, just the way a piano naturally has a tail. And for Western music, this was particularly important because a flute cannot play a chord. If I tell the flutist to play three notes simultaneously, he can't. But the reverberation becomes a chord of three sequential notes. So a piano can play a chord, a flute can play a chord in the space. So spreading in time became part of our musical tradition. It produced blending, and a good composer, especially in the 19th century, understood, depending on the space and temporal spreading, it would produce a good effect. There's a completely different experience of an enclosed space, and that is reverberation as spatial spreading. As you are listening in a concert hall, as I was last night, the reverberation tail is coming from all over, and it's one of the few events where you can't tell me where it's coming from. So if I say to you, where is the reverberation process coming from, you can't tell me. You're in it. And so an enclosed space is one of the few situations where you can't identify the localization. But if you go back to a much earlier slide, which I skipped over, nature wanted you to know where sound is coming from, and localization was part of your auditory system, so you could tell your eyes where to look, so you could see if that was a predator or a non-predator. What happens if you can't tell where a sound is coming from? Well, evolution said you better be careful, you better wake up if you don't know where it's coming from. And so the spatial spreading for us became what I call oral caffeine. It wakes you up. And a lot of music has that in it. And if you listen to some of the music theorists, they'll tell you certain types of music have wake-up attributes. And one of it is the space. And that's why if you listen to that same music on a beach, it doesn't have this kind of impact because you know where it's coming from. And if you stand in the hall and listen to the music through an open door, there's no enveloping. Enveloping is oral caffeine. And we'll skip this. We're going to run out. It, just to show you cultural relativism, in the 1930s, they thought all spatial acoustics was bad. This is the Rockefeller Center, and it has about 6 tons of sound-absorbing material. It is dead as you can believe it. And all of the environment is done with loudspeakers and microphones with no reverberation, no spatial acoustics. And they thought this was great. And it lasted about 15 years until they discovered that this kind of music didn't have any impact. And this is actually the reverse slide, is the counter. Stockhausen in the 60s designed a piece of music just for the caves in Lebanon. And the description of the experience was almost religious to the people who had been there. It has a very unique spatial signature, which is just awe-inspiring, and there were some priests and ministers there. They said they had never experienced anything like that. Now, this was not the music. This was the space they were hearing. The same music, had it been close-mic'd, would have sounded completely flat. Aesthetic spatiality, just like you have wallpaper and you have other things. This is Semper's sculpture in Madrid. It's all these funny-shaped pipes. It was not designed for oral aesthetics. It was designed for visual. It turns out to have some very unique oral properties, which you could simply say provided some texture. It made this space different from other spaces. If you want spaces to look the same, you don't need oral texture. So we have the concept of aesthetic spatiality. Symbolic spatiality is when you hear a certain kind of unique signature over and over again, you begin to associate it with the environment. And one of the classic examples is the cathedrals. This enormous reverberation with its unique properties. In many of the religions, this became an icon or earcon, in my case, of God's home. It acquired meaning through association and experience, and I wish I had more time. This is the last slide I'm going to do. This is a shrine in a particular cathedral. Its properties are so unique, the parishioners who come there and listen to it, I have a recording of it, not here, tell you it was like speaking to God directly. And I've heard this recording. It's very compelling. And if you were to participate in services in this space, you would begin to assumed this was a private telephone to God. It acquires meaning simply from its context. And with that, I will turn it over to my better half, my co-author and wife of 40 years, Linda.
Good evening. Thank you, Barry. That was an enormous amount of information. I'm going to finish our 8-hour lecture in 30 minutes. So hang on. We're going to zoom through. And of course, zoom is both action and hearing. Okay. So what Barry has given us are two important tools. He's given us concepts and he's given us vocabulary. Why do we need concepts? Well, as Barry pointed out, we don't have a good vocabulary. We don't have a good way of describing what we hear. What's more important and more troubling is that we don't tend to pay attention to our oral environment. We don't tend to pay attention to what's happening around us. It's a background. It's like fish in water. Fish don't think about the water. We don't tend to think about our oral environment. We only tend to think about it when it's either very pleasant, and then we say, oh, that's nice. We don't really know why, but we say, oh, that's pleasant. Or when it's very unpleasant, and then we say, oh, that's aversive. I don't want to be in that. Otherwise, we don't pay attention. So as designers, how are you supposed to design if you aren't paying attention to what's going on? So the concepts that Barry introduced us to illuminates, it's another visual notion, illuminates the experience that you're having. And then he gave us a vocabulary. And if you'll take a look at our research, we have a great deal of extensive vocabulary. It's not describing the sound, it's describing the experience. And that's what we're focusing on, the experience of people in space. So my job is to put together all of these and apply it to spaces, to understand what the experience is, to understand the choices we make, both as designers and inhabitants of this experience, and to understand what the consequences of our choices are. Now, once again, oral architecture looks at the dynamic relationship between people and place mediated through hearing. Two important points to keep in mind about this definition. One is relationship. We're interested in the way people and place come together. We're interested in the boundary where they intersect. We're not focusing on space, we're not focusing on people, we're not even focusing on sound. We're interested in where it comes together and they intersect and they affect each other. We're interested in the experience. Secondly, dynamic. The experience is ever-changing. Sound is ever-changing. If sound is an outcome of events, events are happening all the time. An event happens and it disappears. Sound happens and it disappears. Hence, our oral environment is extremely dynamic. It's both an interactive process and it also is moving and changing all the time. Let's take a quick look at the eventscape. The eventscape, as Barry pointed out, is an outcome of events taking place and producing sounds. We take in our environment using all of our senses. So, let me ask the question. Where is this person? Well, physically, he's in a hallway, probably an aquarium, looking in an exhibit, looking through an impermeable glass shield, looking at fish swimming in water, and a very peculiar Central American sculpture, which usually doesn't end up underwater. So, where is he? Well, physically, he's using his oral sense to tell him where he is. He's in a hall. He's hearing other people visiting. He's hearing children chattering. He's hearing a lecture, perhaps a teacher explaining what they're looking at. That's the space he's in. The sounds are being modified by the physical qualities of the space. That's his external physical world. But he's in another place. He's also where his internal mental representation is taking him. Now, he's looking through an impermeable glass wall. He can't hear anything on the other side. So he's using his cognitive strategies. He's using his memory. Perhaps he's gone scuba diving, he's gone snorkeling, he's swum underwater. He remembers what it sounds like to be underwater. So that's in his memory, that's his cognitive strategy. He's also imagining what the space would have been like where that sculpture was located. So he has two things at the same time. He has his external physical world and he has his internal mental representation. Which one is real? Well, they're both real. Where is he? He's in both places at the very same time. He's fused the two spaces together. And we do that all the time. As Barry pointed out, it becomes cognitive loading because it takes a lot of energy for us to not only separate the spaces, but also keep them fused and make sense out of them. Okay, so choices. We all have choices. Designers make choices. They make choices about the permanent physical qualities of a space. Now, these are solid, they're hard, we say they're concrete, they're very literal, and they're also very expensive. Because of this, they're very hard to change. They're permanent, they're there. But inhabitants also make choices. They make choices about how they're going to experience a space. They willingly enter a space that they like. They choose to enter space. But they could also willingly choose to avoid a noisy space. How many of you have decided you're going to meet a friend and you say, well, let's go to that bar. And your friend says, oh, no, no, I don't want to go there. It's too noisy. We can't talk. We can't enjoy ourselves. How many of you will say, well, let's go hear a concert. And you say, oh, I really like that space. So then you choose to enter that space. And in the Kasurkabau that we went to last night, we were thrilled to pieces because the space has such wonderful acoustics. It sounds so good. So you willingly choose, you're willing to avoid. You also shut yourselves off. You use a cognitive strategy. Now let's talk about cognitive strategy for just a moment. Your cognitive strategy is when you take external information, data, and you bring it into your brain and you process that information. You use your memory. You use your brain physiology. You use the physiology of the sound. You use neurophysiology, how we process sounds, what our brains do. You also use social norms, social expectations, social rules to tell you about that sound. You also use cultural values. You put all of that together and you have a cognitive strategy. So we do use a lot of cognitive strategy when we try and respond to a space which has already been designed for us. We adjust the contents, we modify the location, we use our cognitive strategy. Now let's look at this drawing of two individuals. They have been put into each other's physical distance, intimate space. The designer forced them into an intimate space. Are they happy being in each other's intimate space? You tell me by looking at what they've done. Probably going to say, not really. They don't want to be in each other's physical space. So what are they doing? They're using their choices. They probably moved the furniture to make sure that they were back to back. They then are leaning forward, a body attitude. We call that body language, to say, I don't want to be in your space. They're also using selective attention, another cognitive strategy. They're focusing on what their friends are saying, trying to shut out what each other is saying, even though they can hear it. They're using cognitive strategies to make a choice to control their environment. So, oral architecture is the experience that people have in a space. It's also the interaction between choices made by the designer and choices made by the inhabitants. Now, technology gives us a lot of choices. Changing technology gives us more choices, and technology affects how we hear space. So let's take a quick race through about 2,500 years of technology. First, we'll look at building technology, and then we're going to look at modern electronic technology. So we'll go from amphitheaters to iPods. Okay. If you look at the way building technology and stonework has evolved, we start with the Greeks. They used their building technology and they connected that to the natural landscape and they created amphitheaters. This was able to modify the sounds that were made on the stage. They also used reverberating jars to move the sound around. We think that they used megaphones in masks. They also used that backdrop to throw sound forward. So they used a number of technologies. But it was not just the sound that they were interested in. They were also interested in the cultural and social effects of the entire community coming together. The entire community was supposed to be able to come to these and listen to the entire dramatic cycle that was being presented at any one time. Because they were all there, it was a social statement of community. And because they were all there hearing what was being said, it was a cultural value system. They were hearing the values of that community. Let's jump forward 1,000 years. We'll go to a basilica, 6th century. The basilica was also a conscious attempt to use building technology to separate people from the outside world, to separate them from the activities, the noise, and the weather of what was going on outside. They were delineating a sacred space. People chose to come into the space if they chose to be part of the community, and if they chose to hear the values that were being expressed within this space. And you'll notice that that curved background was borrowed from the early Roman courts, where they wanted to project their voice forward so that somebody speaking the values could be heard throughout the space. So again, we're talking about a combination of technology and social norms and cultural values all coming together. It's not just the sound, it's a composite experience. If we jump forward another 500 or 600 years, we look at cathedrals, and this represented another great leap forward in terms of architectural building technology. The original idea of the cathedral, as conceived by the designers and builders, was to make a visual statement of awe and excitement over the message and the institution that was creating this. It was only after they were finished that they discovered that the real impact, as Barry pointed out, was the aural experience. Being in the space and hearing the sounds and the music that actually ended up being composed for this, that created a huge sense of awe, and it became an earconic sound. It became a religious sound. When you hear that kind of reverberation, you immediately think, oh, that's a religious experience. So that's earcons. We jump to music. Early music salons used another kind of building and interior design technology. It was a small private space that was also extremely elegant. Now, this also made a social statement. It was about the group that was in. It was a class statement. If you were in a certain class, then you would want to hear this music. You would all come together. You would look at the elegant surroundings. You'd know how to behave. You would know everybody in that space. The music came to be designed for this space, and so it also became a cultural statement. These are the things that we think are important. So again, the actual sound is only a small part of it. We have to take into account the entire aural architecture. The entire aural architecture was cultural, social, as well as the sounds. We've come finally to a modern, contemporary, 20th century opera house, the Sydney Opera House. This is an iconic view. As architects, you all recognize it. As soon as you see it, you say, oh, that's Sydney. You also know that it's an iconic expression visually of the state of the country of Australia. And I believe it's the only 20th century building that's been turned into a UNESCO National Heritage Site. So visually, it's very important. Modern music halls are marvels of aesthetic design. They have a huge amount of symbolism. Their architectural engineering is amazing. In fact, the Frank Gehry designed Walt Disney Concert Hall, people aren't even sure that it stands. They're worried about it because it's such an amazing thing architecturally. However, the aesthetic quality of the sound is a very mixed issue. In the Gehry Hall, 55% of the seats, I wouldn't pay for them. That's a warning. They're just not that good. In this hall particularly, they always had a problem with the acoustics, and so they ended up deciding that they needed to lower the floor 4 meters and cut into the sandstone base, if you think about it. If you look at the home of the New York Philharmonic in Lincoln Center, they've torn the inside of that out, I believe it's at least twice. And they very specifically ignored the advice that Baranek, who was the acoustician that they hired, they very explicitly ignored his advice, and people couldn't really hear the symphony in that. So again, the sound is only a small part of it. We're looking at cultural issues. We're looking at social issues all combined together. And that's what oral architecture has to take into account. It's not just the sound, it's everything. It's the total experience. Let's jump to electronic music. We'll go back to the early part of the 20th century. At that time, they believed in dry, so-called pure sounds, so they did a close miking where they picked up the immediate sound that was coming out. So we see this in telephones, early vinyl recordings, early radio. They were taking a dry sound and they were transmitting that sound into the space of the listener. They were injecting or importing the sound into a new space. Okay, so they were layering this injected sound onto the eventscape of the listener. The listener's body and the listener's mind were still in the same space. Let's jump to modern times, 50, 60 years later. Completely different situation. Using modern electronics today, we can modify sounds so completely that we create a virtual world. Electronics will create a sound that is totally compelling, has high emotional impact, and it's not real. We call that a virtual soundscape, and we are completely convinced that it is real. They'll have the same sound come at us from five different directions. They'll have a flute playing in a tiny space and a drum playing in a huge space. And we accept the fact that they're both playing in the same space. I recently heard the vocoder. This was invented in the 30s to distort sounds to prevent espionage during the Second World War. And after that, then pop musicians picked it up and they used it to modify sounds. Now, I was listening and they were demonstrating over the radio, so I couldn't see it, over the radio, they were demonstrating the vocoder used to change musical sounds. And I said to myself, wow, I can't hear that distortion. I thought that's how music was supposed to sound. So very quickly we become used to these virtual worlds. Now, if you look at the kid, the cartoon, holding his iPod and surrounded with his earphones, what is he doing? He is experiencing functional deafness because he can't hear where his physical body is. He's completely absorbed in his mental space. We have managed to defy the law of physics. We have taken our mental image and we've transported it elsewhere. His body is one place and his mind is another. Now, I saw somebody walk in with earphones. I wonder if this is familiar to you. It has some positive and some negative qualities. In New York City, three people were killed wearing earphones. So that's just a warning here. Because it was functional deafness. Their mind was in the recording studio in some virtual created world, very compelling. Their bodies, unfortunately, were where the cars and the trucks were, and so they were run over because they literally were not paying attention. Because they couldn't pay attention, they were totally transported. Body one place, mind another place. Positive aspect, trances. How many of you really like to go dancing? Loud music, a loud club, like to go to a loud pop concert? Come on, you can admit it. You all enjoy it. Okay. Good. Thank you. Why do you do that? Because it transports you. You go into a kind of trance state. You're disconnected from your body. You're completely in your mind, and that can be very compelling. Okay. So what we have is a transporting system. Many of us play video games. Movie theaters, we'll sit in a movie theater and be completely transported, home theaters, even automobiles. Today we have automobiles where you can shut yourself off, you don't hear the traffic, you don't hear the sound of the engine, but you have a completely created virtual world by the music that you play in it. Okay. So we have a menu of oral experiences. Technologies offer both designers and inhabitants choices. So do keep in mind that we all have choices. Designers have choices, and the inhabitants of those spaces also have choices. What we'd like to do is urge you not to pay attention so much to the technology, but to the experience, the choices that we make, and those implications. So let's look at a couple of those. One would be overlaid eventscapes. Well, big word. Another concept, another vocabulary. So let's look at this young man. He's actually in two aural environments at the same time. He's in the eventscape where he's doing his homework. Perhaps his sibling is playing a video game. Perhaps a parent is preparing dinner in the kitchen. Perhaps his friends are outside and they're playing soccer and they're saying, come on out and play with us. But he, as you can see, unhappily, is sticking with doing his homework. Well, let's say that he puts on earphones. But they're not the kind of earphones that shut out sound. He can still hear where his body is. And so he's making the choice of moving back and forth between what he's hearing in his earphones and what he's hearing in his eventscape. That's another cognitive strategy that we use. And he can choose with his cognitive strategy to have functional deafness, or he can choose with his cognitive strategy to tune into his environment. He's popping back between the two of them. In this case, he has a choice and he's exercising his choice. Now, we call this an overlaid eventscape because he's in two eventscapes at the same time. And it's a little bit like a double exposure, one picture on top of the other. We've seen this in the real world. How many of you have noticed somebody walking down a city street talking to themselves? The first time I saw that, I really thought they were crazy. I didn't realize, I'm old-fashioned, that you could wear a headpiece that was really tiny, and you can't see that they're wearing it. So they're talking away perfectly happily. They're in two eventscapes at the same time. How many of you have been in a market and a person's chattering away and you want to say, excuse me, I'm here. Could you move? And they're really aware of both at the same time. They'll chatter to a friend and then they'll stop and they'll order fish for dinner and then they'll go back to chattering at their friend. We do that quite often. That's an overlaid space. This is very different from overlapping aural horizon. So what's an overlapping aural horizon? Well, the overlapping aural horizon means that we are in multiple spaces at the same time. Let's say you're in a large train station. You're talking to your friend. So that's this aural horizon. There's a couple next to you talking very loudly about where to go for dinner tonight. You're hearing them. You're in the next space, which is the large train station, and you're paying attention to that. So you have overlapping aural horizons, and again, you move back and forth. We consider this democratic. It gives you a choice. Anyone who can afford the mind transporter device that this young man is using, anyone who can afford the mind transporter device of earphones, they can have a choice. Now, let's look at combat in the eventscape. This is what happens when a single sonic environment takes over the entire eventscape. We have three examples here: a very busy city street where a pile driver is working. We have the very large sound systems that you find in clubs or concerts. And then you have a group of motorcycles zooming down a street. Okay. What happens is that the single event takes over. Now, sound and our old environment is supposed to be a shared resource. But it's entirely possible for a single event to grab that environment and take over and engage in what we call sonic tyranny. It's a monosonic soundscape. Sometimes when that happens, the control over our soundscape is taken away from us. We can also choose to put ourselves into that space, as when we go to a club or a concert, and then we are willingly giving over control to somebody else. In the end, technology and our own resources, our own strategies, give us choices. Now let's look at multiple eventscapes as we go through our daily life. In our bedroom, you are in control of the design, as well as the sounds that are interjected into that space. You then move to a public transit system, and the control is kind of an iffy thing. It's very noisy, other people are talking. You can choose to block it out, develop functional deafness using electronics, Or you can chat with a friend and block it out using your cognitive strategy. When you go into the city street, that really is sonic tyranny. You can't do anything but hear the busy, noisy sounds of the street. When you go into your office, this is a very good example of where, even though you're staying in one place, your eventscapes are changing while you're there. Remember, we said that eventscapes are dynamic. They change. Somebody comes in, they start talking, somebody yells at you, yells to you, I should say. Your telephone rings, somebody's rattling papers, suddenly there's a meeting, everybody goes to lunch, now it's quiet. You have a series of eventscapes in that one space all through the course of the day. Then at the end of the day, you choose to go and hear your kids. Notice I say hear your kids playing, because if anybody has attended a kid's soccer game, it's very noisy. And then finally, you end up back again in a controlled environment. And this is with your family. And as long as you can keep the telephone from ringing, and as long as you can keep somebody from turning on the television to hear the news, then you are completely in control. You've decided the nature of that eventscape. Okay. We have more and more international design. We're creating globalized spaces, and these globalized spaces are uniform. We have shopping malls, theaters, hospitals, schools, public transit stations. These are all designed with the same geometries, with very similar volumes, with very similar material. And so the way that the sounds are modified become the same. And the activities that we engage in these spaces are the same. So this is a very good example of where we are taking choices away rather than working with the array of choices that are available, earconic sounds, earmarks, which note a particular space, we're taking choices away. Okay. So, who's in charge? Is it the designer of the space who makes a concrete specific space, or is it the inhabitants who can control their spaces using cognitive strategies and electronics? Well, actually, both. Because you can create the very hard space, but then the person coming in or deciding not to go in, they are making their own choices too. Now, designers can influence the aural horizons of the inhabitants. They can use sound barriers. They can absorb sound. They can make a highly reverberant space. They can link two spaces. They can separate two spaces. Designers can influence how people experience the aural space. And then, of course, users can also. They can use their cognitive strategies. They can choose to enter a space and or many of the things that we already talked about. So, who is the aural architect? Well, in fact, both. The aural architect is both the designer and the person who comes into that space or chooses not to. So we can call them outsiders and insiders. Outsiders are architects, planners, designers, and artists who create spaces with certain physical acoustics and certain embedded sounds. Now, they're outsiders because they rarely experience the spaces that they design. They're really guessing, if they even think about it, what those spaces are going to sound like. So they create a space and then they leave. And they leave it for the insiders. The insiders are the inhabitants of a space. They're there every day in their daily lives. Now, we've already seen that it's very hard to describe your aural space. It's hard to describe the sounds that you hear. So we've invented concepts and vocabulary to discuss that. Because in the end, it's really important for the insiders and the outsiders to be able to talk together. The outsiders, the designers, are coming along with their own value system, and they're often putting that value system onto the spaces and therefore onto the aural experience, the aural architecture. Now, we have, these are two eventscapes that are completely different. One is a natural, contemplative, quiet, even with the snow, almost silent eventscape, and the other one is completely the opposite. It's urban, it's man-made, it's very crowded, it's high stimulation. We want to make it very clear that we don't think that one type of eventscape is better than another. There isn't a better or a worse eventscape. There's only the kind you want. Okay? So we say you season to taste. Different people will choose different eventscapes according to what they need. And within the same lifetime, within the same day, the same individual will go ahead and choose different eventscapes, whatever works for them. So, summary is, pay attention to the experience. Don't focus on the technology. Don't focus on the concrete design. Don't worry about the individual strategies. Focus on the experience, the point where the person and the place intersect. What is a person experiencing in that space? The interaction between the two. The oral architecture is what's important. Use common concepts. Use common language. If we do that, then we have an opportunity to create spaces which are meaningful, functional, and enjoyable. And we recommend two things. We recommend humility. We don't know very much. We're still very much learning. Try not to put your assumptions and your value systems onto a place. Leave options, leave choices for people to use their cognitive strategies and their technology to respond to your space. And the second point is empathy. Try to put yourself into the position of the person who is inhabiting that space. Move yourself into their world. What is it going to sound like? And when you're able to use both humility and empathy, I think at the end, you'll have a meaningful, functional, and enjoyable space. And thank you.